From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Juvenile crime rates have been falling in North Carolina. They could fall even more if the state moves forward with an idea called Raise the Age. You'll learn the details. The state school board recently reviewed North Carolina's latest school dropout report. You'll hear highlights along with the board's reaction. American founder Alexander Hamilton's historical reputation has been riding high in recent years. A Duke professor sheds light on the truth of Hamilton's classical liberal political philosophy. And you'll learn some key facts Governor Roy Cooper did not mention when his State of the State speech praised school teachers who pay for school supplies out of their own pockets. Speaking of the State of the State, that's our first topic. As Donna Martinez joins us, she has the Carolina Journal headline.
The disagreements between Democratic Governor Roy Cooper and the Republican-led General Assembly are based not only in public policy, but in the world view of the role that government should play in our lives. Those divergent views were on display for all to see when Governor Cooper gave his recent State of the State address, followed by an address from Senate Leader Phil Berger. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. He watched and listened to both men lay out their visions. He's here to talk about that. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
Let's talk first about Governor Cooper and his State of the State address. What was the overarching message that you received?
He said North Carolina is a state of promise, and he was talking very much about the fact that the state does have a lot to offer to people, but his argument was that the state used to be a better place when government was more active. So he made a very strong statement about the role of the public universities, about the tax climate here and the like, and it was basically talking about the role of public services in making the state a better place and training the workforce and that type of thing. And so it was a fairly all of these speeches tend to be laundry lists of things that the governor wants. And as far as the substance was concerned, it was relatively pedestrian. But then again, you're not going to get much better than that from Roy Cooper, mistake him for a great orator, and very few governors are. But it was very much this is a state of promise if we will just simply have the government do more stuff.
In other words, go back to the way things used to be, which ended up being kind of a major theme of the response from Republican Senate Leader Phil Berger.
Yeah, that's right. Senator Berger was opened up, I think, very forcefully by talking about how under the leadership of the Republicans in the General Assembly, we had made promises, we kept our promises, and as a result, the state turned around in various ways. He mentioned the fact that the tax climate, business tax climate, relatively speaking, has improved dramatically, that people are keeping more of their money, that the state's building up savings reserves, that our jobs are increasing, that pay's increasing, that we're becoming a leader in the Southeast when we weren't beforehand. And the time now is not to look back to the past, to some wonderful era that existed, because it wasn't a wonderful era. He called it a mirage, actually. That's what he called Roy Cooper's vision.
And that leads me to what I said at the introduction of this segment, which is it seems like these two men and their respective parties in North Carolina really do have opposite views about the role that government should play in our lives and whether we are going forward or backward.
Right. They really do. And it was striking to see that contrast come forward. And there was actually one little anomalous part of the governor's State of the State address that was perhaps one of the most touching ones, but also one of the strangest ones if you look at his overall vision, because he brought forward the example of the young woman who started a food bank right before Hurricane Matthew hit, and how thanks to the donations and contributions of members of the community and businesses and the like, that this food bank was able to distribute relief supplies to people during Hurricane Matthew. Well, this was not a government program. And what he was trying to do was to give this example of North Carolina as a place where people pull together and people, you know, fight through problems and come up with their solutions. But that was not a government program. And in that way, it was the most touching, perhaps, little vignette he gave during the entire talk. But it had nothing to do with his other vision of let's increase spending and let's do all these things to increase government programs. And so it was this example of how a lot of us on the center right think that the world should act, is that people, you know, should come up and with their own decisions and should gather their resources together and help each other without bureaucrats intervening. But it seemed sort of out of place in the governor's address.
He also mentioned the middle class, and these days it seems like every politician, every elected official wants to say, hey, I'm the person, I'm the guy, I'm the gal who's really, you know, looking out for the middle class. And then Senate Leader Phil Berger, it seems like part of his argument is, yeah, we agree, and we, the Republicans, we've been helping the middle class.
Right, right. A difference, once again, of policy and of structure in that Governor Cooper's response to the middle class is to increase a tax credit for childcare, for instance, or to make community college free. Of course, it's not really free. It just means the out-of-pocket cost directly from the student will be zero.
Right. Someone else pays for it.
Someone else will pay for it. And other sorts of ideas dealing with increasing pay for certain middle-class occupations, namely teachers. And Senator Berger's answer is more, well, we're providing tax relief to everyone, which allows members of the middle class, we're going to increase the zero tax bracket, or we're going to do other things to keep the state's savings accounts intact so that we don't have to raise taxes on the middle class and on everybody if we have a downturn and things like that. So it's much more of a with the governor, it's much more of a targeting certain individuals who do things that he likes. And on the side of Senator Berger and the Republicans, it's much more of a let's give relief to everybody and let them make their own decisions.
Now, you mentioned education. And just to let our listeners know, a little bit later on in the program, we're going to be talking with our own Dr. Terry Stoops. We're going to get into the governor's comments and Senator Berger's comments as well, specifically about education. Rick, so after hearing and watching these two men give their visions and how they view North Carolina, not only our status today, but what our future could look like. What does this say about going forward, the policy decisions that need to be made? We've got a budget that's looming. We've got all sorts of other things that are on the table for discussion. Is there any possibility of agreement anywhere along the line here?
There's some general areas of agreement. They're both going to be supporting economic development projects. Now, There will be some differences about specifically how those will go forward, but they will respond to measures for economic development. They might actually agree on some sort of deal to attempt to create mega sites to lure large industrial manufacturers here. That's possible. They also, and this is, I think, a big victory for the Republicans, they also agree that not every tax dollar that is collected should be spent immediately. Governor Cooper has $300 million going into various savings accounts. I would have a feeling that the Senate budget, which will come out after this recording is made, but before this show was aired, the Senate budget would have a larger contribution to that. But this was something that Governor Cooper, as a candidate, was criticizing on the campaign trail last week, that the Republicans were saving too much. Well, all of a sudden now he says it's really important to save for a rainy day. So they will agree on that aspect of things. And also they will agree to increase compensation for teachers. They will just differ on how it should be done, whether it should go to high-performing teachers who teach in difficult-to-staff schools, or whether it should be more across the board and more targeted toward, say, long-tenured teachers rather than younger teachers.
Rick, we can't really ignore the elephant in the room, and that is the courts. I mean, there are legal battles, a number of them, that are going on right now between the Republicans and the Democratic governor. Should we expect more of that?
I think what we're going to see right now is probably things carrying forward. What we may see that's new is that the governor and the attorney general, Josh Stein, both of whom are Democrats, have said or have taken action in recent weeks to remove themselves from litigation that the previous administration had gotten involved in. And this is at the discretion of the governor, of course. And these were things in which basically the federal government was trying to do something. The state wanted to roll it back and the state sued. And now that may be changing.
And Carolina Journal will be reporting updates on those legal cases. And Rick, also folks can follow you on Twitter at
Deregulator
and Carolina Journal's Twitter feed, which is at Carolina Journal. Rick Henderson, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina has seen major improvement in its juvenile crime rate, and one idea linked to juvenile crime is bound to get quite a bit of attention this year in the halls of the General Assembly. Joining us for a brief overview of juvenile crime issues in North Carolina is William Lassiter. He's Deputy Commissioner overseeing juvenile justice in the North Carolina Department of Public Safety. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So we're going to talk about this interesting idea called Raise the Age in a bit. But first, let's talk about juvenile crime in North Carolina. I understand that the numbers have been getting better and consistently better over the last 9 years or so.
Absolutely. In fact, we've seen a 9-year decrease in the juvenile crime rate in the state of North Carolina. This is somewhat tied to the national trend that we've seen that juvenile crime is going down, but North Carolina's rate has decreased far greater than the national average on reducing juvenile crime. And we've done that while at the same time reducing the number of kids that are in confinement in our facilities across the state of North Carolina. And that's really important to folks because it costs a lot of money to confine a juvenile in a facility. And we know that serving a juvenile in the community with their family is a much better approach. And so that effective approach of holding those kids in the community, providing services around them in the community, and working with the whole family has paid off great dividends for the state of North Carolina. So we've seen 9 years straight of reduced juvenile crime. We've also seen an 82% reduction in the number of kids in confinement in the state of North Carolina in our long-term committed facilities, which we call youth development centers. And we've also seen almost a 50% decrease in the number of juveniles held in juvenile detention centers, which are short-term facilities while a kid is awaiting trial in the state of North Carolina.
Are there particular factors you can identify as to why that improvement's taken place?
What we have done in the state, in our state, in 1999, we passed the Juvenile Reform Act, and that really encouraged communities to wrap around the juveniles in their local area to make sure that they were going to be successful. And so that Juvenile Reform Act has made a huge difference. But we've also put in place in our facilities a system that we call the model of care. And this model of care really focuses on teaching kids life skills while they're with us. Instead of just warehousing them and holding them in a cell all day, we actually bring them out, teach them. They have to be involved in education. They have to be involved in the life skills groups throughout the day. And that approach has reduced our recidivism rates in those facilities from kids leaving those facilities. From when I first started, it was 79%. Today, it's down to 41%. So almost a half of what the recidivism rate used to be. And that's over 3 years after they leave the facility. So that's a huge reduction in recidivism that we've been able to accomplish by putting in place this new approach. So we've changed what we're doing in our facilities, and we've also changed what we're doing in the communities by making sure that we have that wraparound approach in the local communities for juveniles also.
You mentioned recidivism, and for those who are unfamiliar with the topic, these are the people who leave the system but then come back within short order. That has big long-term positive impacts, doesn't it, if that recidivism rate goes down?
Absolutely. So the cost-benefit of that to the normal citizen in the state of North Carolina, by not having a child recidivate, we save on lifetime time earnings for that juvenile. They actually are good tax-paying citizens of the state of North Carolina. But it also saves you from not having your house broken into or have your stuff stolen. And so by reducing victimization, by reducing the number of times that that juvenile is going to enter the adult system, we see reduced court costs and reduce future imprisonment of that juvenile later in life. So it saves the taxpayer a whole lot of money. In fact, one study that we looked at that was done of the cost-benefit analysis of Raise the Age, which we're going to talk about in a second, is saving one juvenile from a life of crime saves the taxpayer of the state of North Carolina almost $1 million.
That is the voice of William Lassiter. He's a deputy commissioner in the North Carolina Department of Public Safety overseeing juvenile justice. You referenced this just a moment ago. Let's turn to this subject now of Raise the Age. Before we get into the potential benefits, just tell us what Raise the Age would mean.
Well, currently in the state of North Carolina, you are seen to be an adult in the adult criminal justice system at the age of 16. So you end up not being a juvenile anymore once you turn 16 years old. We're the only one of two states left in the country where that's the case. In most states, you're not considered to be an adult until you turn 18 years old. So this proposal is actually looking at how do you treat a juvenile that's 16 or 17 years old in the criminal justice system. Should you treat them as a juvenile or should you treat them as an adult? And so that's really what this proposal is looking at. And what we're specifically talking about, why this is important, is because we know that the brain development of a 16 and 17-year-old is different than an 18, 19, or 20-year-old in the system. We know that the system that we have set up in the juvenile justice system is much more appropriate for those juveniles by keeping them in the juvenile justice system for a couple of reasons. Number one, we work with the whole family. And that's a big difference from the adult system. You can be arrested in the state of North Carolina at the age of 16, and your parents don't even have to be called. We think that if a juvenile gets arrested at the age of 16, that their parents must be involved and should be involved. That actually helps us make sure that we deal with the whole system that caused the juvenile to get in trouble in the first place. Secondly, we know that the approaches that we use in the juvenile justice system are much more appropriate for that population, for 16 and 17-year-olds. Right now, if you get convicted of a drug crime, for example, at 16 years old, you're going to be in a group setting with a 50-year-old sitting right beside you that has also had a drug offense. We know that that's not the most appropriate place for that juvenile. It's just like you don't take your child to a regular doctor. You take them to a pediatrician. We have the manpower and the resources and the knowledge to work with this population in the juvenile justice system much more effectively and much more efficiently.
A lot of this comes down in some respects to specifics of the bill, because when you're talking about 16 and 17-year-old offenders, there are many different types of things that they could be charged with.
Absolutely.
The ones who would be treated as juveniles under this proposal, what types of crimes would they have committed? I'm sure you're not talking about murder or the most serious crimes.
Absolutely. So A through E felonies would be exempt from this policy. A through E felonies are typically the ones that you think of as the most violent and most serious offenses that someone could commit. So that includes everything from rape and murder. All of those would stay in the adult system. It's the other offenses, mainly misdemeanors. In fact, of the 16 and 17-year-old population that we're looking at, 67% of all offenses are misdemeanors that come into the system. And then the other ones, only 3% fall into that A through E category to begin with. So most of what juveniles are committing are actually low-end felonies or misdemeanor crimes that occur in schools or in their households or in their communities across the state of North Carolina. So those A through E's would be exempt from this policy.
Now, in hearing people discuss this, one of the things that I've heard as a potential roadblock or an obstacle is coming from some prosecutors who have been saying, look, you know, we like this idea of the 16 and 17-year-olds and making sure that they get the type of help they need. But some of these folks, by the time they're 16 or 17, they're already hardened criminals, members of gangs. You don't want them in with the other juveniles. Are there ways to address all of these concerns and still have a good bill?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things that we hear is especially the gang influence over juveniles, and that sometimes juveniles are used to commit gang crimes by older adult offenders. And what we would like to see is that the bill actually address that older population. If you're contributing to the delinquency of a minor, that should be a more serious offense than what it is right now. It's a misdemeanor in the system. So why harm the juvenile that we can save and address in the system while it's an adult causing them to commit those types of crimes? The other things that prosecutors often bring up are the habitual offenders, like you're saying. Actually, the juvenile justice system can hold those habitual offenders very much accountable in the juvenile justice system. In fact, because they'll have a history in the juvenile justice system with us, we can actually use that history to give them a much more severe consequence than they would probably get as an adult when they're first starting out in the adult system. And so that habitual offender, actually the points add up, their previous points add up and can actually cause them to have a greater accountability measure that's put in place.
We'll raise the age. We know it's a topic that is going to be discussed during the session of the General Assembly. One of the people who will be weighing in on that issue is William Lassiter. He's a deputy commissioner in the North Carolina Department of Public Safety overseeing juvenile justice. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you looking to make North Carolina more free? The John Locke Foundation is, and here are three things you can do today to help us make it happen. First, know the facts. Visit johnlocke.org for data, analysis, interviews, and more. And read carolinajournal.com to learn what government is doing with your money. Second, influence the debate. Invest in the John Locke Foundation's work with a tax-deductible donation. You can get it done in less than 90 seconds at johnlocke.org. And third, make North Carolina more free by sharing the message of freedom. It's easy when you visit johnlocke.org. Click on shareables, download, pass the messages of freedom to your friends, print the messages and mail them. Or if you're a savvy computer user, share the message of freedom on Facebook and Twitter. Know the facts, influence the debate, and share the message. Three things you can do today to help us make North Carolina more free. Get started today at johnlocke.org.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina public schools saw a decline in high school dropouts last year. Ken Gaddis of the State Department of Public Instruction recently outlined the details.
We had a decrease this year, and we went down from 11,190 in 14-15 to 10,889. That's 301 fewer. And a decrease of 2.7%. So we're not quite at our lowest point right now because we had an increase last year, but we did have a decrease.
A new rule allows schools to avoid counting students as dropouts if they're jointly enrolled with a community college.
We had 307 students that received the exception this year from 40 LEAs and one charter. What would have happened if we had had to report the 307 this year? Like we always did in the past, the top chart shows that we would have had 11,196. We would have had six more dropouts than we had last year. However, we still would have had a decrease in dropout rate. We would have gone from to 2.36 instead of to 2.29.
Where are North Carolina students dropping out?
We have that high area in the northeastern coastal plain, sort of inland coastal plain. I don't know how to define that. But that is an artifact of the fact that we've done correlations before, and dropouts do correlate with the dropout rate by LEA correlates with suspension rates. We've done that year after year, and we see that.
Gaddis noted one more trend.
In Charlotte, we're having large numbers of dropouts from a couple of high schools that actually specialize in at-risk students. So these are students that are at risk for dropping out. And so that's just a trend that I think we need to keep an eye on.
State School Board member A.L. Buddy Collins wants some additional information.
I know we have several different programs that are dealing with dropouts, which may reduce the numbers that are being reported to you. For example, in Davidson County, they have a Davidson High School, for example, which is an alternative type school. And the kind of thing that I'm interested in is sort of correlating the successful alternative programs with the impact on the dropout rate. And I don't know whether you've done that or not, but it would help us to understand what programs are working and which ones need to be replicated as we're looking at a 18-year-old compulsory attendance age.
You've been listening to a recent discussion of North Carolina's latest report on public school dropouts. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you tired of fake news? Well, you won't find it here. At Carolina Journal, we don't make things up and we don't presume or assign motives. There's no simpler way to put it than that. We're proud to say that honest, factual, rigorous journalism is the Carolina Journal way. Our reporting team is focused on accountability in government and policymaking, no matter which political party is in power and regardless of the person taken to task in the story. At Carolina Journal, we're beholden to the truth and to transparency. Unlike fake news, lies, innuendo, questionable sourcing, all meant to create controversy, not inform the debate. So the next time you're confronted with fake news, log on to CarolinaJournal.com or pick up the latest print edition. You'll find compelling news reporting from a team that knows what it means to be real journalists, committed to truth. Carolina Journal, you can count on us for the facts.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Mention the name Alexander Hamilton today, and you're likely to encounter at least some measure of recognition. We see his face on the $10 bill, and many people have heard of a Broadway musical devoted to this American founder. But what do people know about Hamilton's actual record or his approach to public policy? Our next guest says many people on both the political left and right get Hamilton wrong. Richard Zalzman is assistant professor of political economy at Duke University. He recently addressed the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society on the topic Hamilton's Liberalism, Facts and Myths. Thanks for joining us.
It's good to be here. Thank you, Mitch.
So before we get into what Alexander Hamilton really believed, how do people on both the left and right get him wrong?
On the left, to which today are called liberals, they're actually advocates of heavy government intervention in the economy. And they interpret Hamilton as their supporter. On the right, if you want to go far to the right, say the libertarians, who some of them lean more anarchist, also think he's a statist, also think that Hamilton's a statist and tend to endorse Jeffersonian principles. I use liberal in the classical sense, in the Lockean, Montesquieuan sense, that liberal meaning pro-liberty. And in classical liberalism, the term itself was required to distinguish from modern liberalism. We had to go back and say, well, no, they were classical liberals. They actually wanted constitutionally limited government. They actually wanted a free economy. That's Hamilton. My theme has been that is Hamilton through and through. He is not a statist So he can't be criticized by the right for that, nor claimed by the left for that. He occupies this position of being a true classical liberal. He believed in equal rights for all. He was against racism and slavery. Possibly the most important beyond that, the constitutional limitations on government. The anti-federalists, who were largely Jeffersonian, opposed the forming of a constitution. They wanted the 13 states to remain separate. Hamilton effectively put the U in the USA. So he's a constitutionally he's for constitutionally limited government as well. And lastly, I also talk about political economy and foreign policy. In political economy, he's pro-capitalist in the following sense. He believes all sectors of the economy are productive, not just agriculture, you know, but also manufacturing and finance and trade, whereas the Jeffersonians, literally adopting what was amounted to physiocracy from France, believed only agriculture was productive. They said even that only virtuous, which by implication meant all the other sectors were in some ways parasitical. So the whole class warfare that we see today between Main Street and Wall Street and, you know, real workers versus these paper shufflers is totally a Jeffersonian type distinction. And lastly, we can talk about it, but foreign policy, he's a realist. He puts national interests first. He doesn't think we should make the world safe for democracy because ultimately he doesn't trust democracy. He doesn't trust unlimited majority rule. He thinks it can become tyranny, whereas the Jeffersonians are largely for unlimited majority rule.
We're speaking with Richard Salzman, assistant professor of political economy at Duke University, and we're talking, of course, about Alexander Hamilton, who many of you have heard of at least as the subject of a Broadway musical and perhaps as the person whose face is on the $10 bill. There was some discussion about taking Hamilton
– plus
the duel with Aaron Burr.
The vice president killed him.
Yes, that's right. That's right. There was some discussion about taking Hamilton's face off the $10 bill.
Yes.
He was rescued, and I suspect – as someone who's talking about him as the consummate classical liberal, you're glad he's going to stay on that bill.
I am glad. And I wrote at the time that he should remain on the bill. But you know, they wanted a more democratic choice. And so it couldn't have been more curious, because here was Hamilton basically saying democracy can be very dangerous. It can actually lead to fiscal profligacy and bankruptcy of the state. So here he is because of unlimited majority desire for spending without taxing. You know, there's like a built-in bias toward deficit spending. That's another myth about Hamilton. He's seen sometimes as, well, since he wanted to pay the national debt, he must have been one of these proto-Keynesians who wanted national debt or thought government debt was somehow stimulative. None of that's true either. So, yes, I wanted him to stay on the 10. That doesn't necessarily mean people know more about Hamilton, but to get him off the currency to me seemed unjust and improper.
Why do people have the wrong idea about Alexander Hamilton?
I think some of it is Jefferson and the Jeffersonians tend to be more lyrical, poetic, and flowery in their writings and speeches. Hamilton is more lawyerly, more dry, more logical, more prolix, actually, which is another word for using too many words. And so that's part of it. But I think part of it also is the when people look back to the founders, they want to see them as condoning or supporting their current position, you know. So it's like almost like an appeal to authority. And since Jefferson and Hamilton disagreed on so much, and I'm saying legitimately disagreed, I mean, there were big differences between there of the kind I've just mentioned. If you're at all a Jeffersonian, you think Hamilton's the devil, because Jefferson did. And Jeffersonian biographers and scholars think Hamilton's the devil. So we have this kind of, you know, Jefferson as Dudley Do-Right and, you know, Hamilton as Snidely Whiplash, you know, if you know the old cartoons. And so some of it is just sheer caricature, which is not the same thing as historical accuracy.
I get the sense also that if you look back at these debates between Jefferson and Hamilton, Jefferson obviously wrote great things, had great ideas. Hamilton sometimes seems to come across as the person who had a better grip on how the world actually works. Would you agree with that?
Well, when you say actually works, that gets back to my point about realism. Yes, Hamilton's basic view was, let's take humanity as it is, the good and the bad of it. People have free will. They could choose to do good or ill. Let's not become idealistic or idyllic about what's possible. Specifically, he said, let's not become that way about the populace in general. Jefferson and the Jeffersonians generally thought, in a Rousseau-type way, that the more you could capture what was called the general will or majority opinion, they literally thought that was more accurate. They had, and so the distrust for elites, the distrust for expert opinion, we see this even today, the distrust of establishment. These are debates we have even today, right? The suspicion is the elites and the establishment have only their own self-aggrandizement at heart. The Jeffersonians think that's always checked by the popular will. Hamilton and the Federalists thought, you know, the popular will is easily demagogued, easily exploited by those who take advantage of people's prejudices, ignorance. And so he was much more suspicious of politicians like Jefferson, frankly, who would use flowery language and appeal to the people as a kind of flattering of the people.
So in the remaining time that we have, if people want to learn more about Hamilton, what he actually stood for, why he is an important founder, why he should stay on the $10 bill, what's the best thing for them to do?
Well, a couple of pieces by me, if you just Google Salzman defense of Hamilton, you'll get one or two pieces specifically on him on the bill a couple of years ago. But I would name a couple of books. One, Ron Chernow's biography of Hamilton in 2004 is very good and was actually the basis for the musical. So for those of you who are interested in the musical and its origins, it basically comes from Chernow's wonderful biography. More philosophically, there's a book by Michael Federici, called The Political Philosophy of Alexander Hamilton. That's a little more scholarly, a little more in-depth as to his actual views. That's a very good book as well.
Well, Alexander Hamilton, more than just the face on the $10 bill and more than just the subject of a musical and a person who says that we should recognize him as the consummate classical liberal, is Richard Salzman, assistant professor of political economy at Duke University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Earlier in the program, Carolina Journal Editor-in-Chief Rick Henderson reviewed the themes of Governor Roy Cooper's recent State of the State address. One of those major themes was education. Now, one expert who has been paying special attention to the governor's message on that issue is our own Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the John Locke Foundation's Director of Research and Education Studies. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
Now, the governor focused in his speech on a number of overarching themes having to do with education, but he also focused in on several individual teachers and the fact that teachers are using some of their own money to buy supplies. So the first question I have for you is, why should teachers be spending their own money to buy supplies? It just seems crazy.
That's a great question, considering before the beginning of the school year, there are long lists of items that teachers request parents to buy and bring those in on the first day of school with their children. And we're not just talking about pencils and paper, but we're talking about wipes and other and tissues and other things that the teachers believe that they will need throughout the school year. And parents report paying $50 or $100 per child for these long list of items. And so there's a stockpile of things that teachers receive at the beginning of the year, items that they believe to be central to their classroom. Not only that, but the school district, of course, provides various items for that teacher's paper and other things. So it really does beg the question of why a teacher would invest their own money when parents are spending hundreds of dollars to provide supplies, and schools are also contributing a significant amount of money and into what the teacher needs for their classroom.
What I thought was really curious about this, and I've heard this a number of times, well, teachers have to buy their own supplies. Number one, I think regardless of anyone's politics or ideology, if that were accurate, that they were literally running out of supplies at schools and teachers were being forced to go buy them, we should all be concerned about that. That's kind of the impression that is left by comments like that. Is that true?
Well, you have to look at what some teachers decide to buy. Some of them are just decor for their classroom. Certainly is not necessary in any way to buy construction paper for a board or some kind of border for their classroom. And they do so because they want their classroom to look a certain way and not necessarily do anything to improve their instructional delivery or anything like that. So, you know, we never get a list of what teachers buy. We always just hear that teachers are buying stuff. And while that's true, the question is, are they buying things that actually will help them in the classroom or just make their classroom look pretty?
So that was one of the curious things that was that the governor was talking about. But also, of course, he was talking about much larger issues of teacher compensation and where we go in terms of education in North Carolina. You've actually been trying to get information on specific information on teacher compensation. Tell us what you've been trying to do and why.
Well, I've been trying to see how much teachers make.
It's that simple.
It's not easy to find individual salary levels for teachers. We can know how much the average teacher makes, which is close to $50,000 a year in North Carolina. We know what some of the district averages are. But if you were to identify one teacher and ask me how much they make, it's very difficult to figure out what that is. It's because each district maintains those records, and sometimes districts make it hard to get those records on individual teacher payroll figures. Even though it is a public record, you have to go to each of North Carolina's 115 school districts to get that data. It's not maintained by the state, and so I have tried over the years to accumulate that data with the help of some friends here in the John Locke Foundation, and have found it very difficult. But it is out there, and it can be obtained.
And we should say, Terry, that it's not that you just have some strange interest in finding out what other people are making, but there's public money here, and there's a very big debate, an ongoing debate among politicians and policymakers, many arguing that teachers do not make enough money. And so that really is at the heart of your investigation here.
Well, especially since the media is always highlighting individual teachers. And seldom do those stories come with salary levels or discussion of what type of situation those teachers are in. So when you're talking about individual teachers and you're making the claim that they don't make enough, I think it's important to know how much they do make and how does that compare to per capita income in the state? How does that compare with other professionals in the county or in the region? Those are important data points that are often left out of news stories because they want to tug at heartstrings, and they know that people automatically believe that teachers as a general category are underpaid. They believe that. They've always been told that. But the reality is there are some teachers that make a very good living. And they do so in areas that others do not make such a good living. And it's important to know how much those individual teachers make, especially if the claim is they don't make enough.
We've been hearing from the governor, and we've been also hearing from some Republicans who say, look, we need to raise teacher pay. They have been getting raises, though, now. For several years.
Without a doubt. If you look at the last three raises teachers received in North Carolina, and this is through Republican leadership in the General Assembly, 3 years ago, it was a 7% increase. 2 years ago, it was a 2.1% increase. And last year, it was a 4.7% increase. These are average increases, so it didn't necessarily hit every teacher in the same way. But those are substantial increases that required hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayer money to be invested in our education system. And I think that the recognition or the failure to recognize that the Republicans have done a great deal to raise teacher pay in North Carolina is unfortunate. But still, it is without a doubt that they have raised teacher pay. The average teacher pay has gone up $5,000 to $6,000 since Republicans have started raising teacher pay substantially in the last 3 years. And I think this year we're going to see another substantial pay increase. I think it'll probably be in the 4.5% to 5.5% range. And if we see a raise of that magnitude, not only will the average teacher pay make far over $50,000 a year, but they will approach that $55,000 a year mark on average.
Terry, is there any effort underway, any appetite in the legislature to try to start distinguishing teachers based on stellar performance, or even to somehow tie their salaries, or at least a portion of it, to their impact on student achievement?
There is, and I have to hand it to the Republicans in the General Assembly have been very deliberate about this, because if you look around the nation, attempts at large-scale efforts to try to provide some sort of incentive or performance pay have not always panned out. So they've been very deliberate about going about making sure that they look at not only research-based programs, but they do so through a pilot program system where they take a couple school districts and they try it out, see what works and what doesn't, and they move on from there. I think this is the kind of deliberate approach that a lot of states haven't taken that we have taken, and Republicans should be commended for investing funds in those teachers that really are making a demonstrable difference in student achievement. Because too often those are the teachers that look to other professions or try to find other ways to supplement their income, when in reality we need to make sure that they continue to focus on the classroom and make sure that they continue to raise student achievement in North Carolina.
Well, we know that we're still pretty early on in the whole budgeting process. We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the John Locke Foundation's Director of Research and Education Studies. You can read all of his analysis at johnlocke.org and carolinajournal.com. Terry, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll come back again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.